This is XTP Media.
It's kind of too good to be true. You've got these kind of heavy machinery, which really shouldn't be flying, but it is. I think that combination, when you have art and science interact in that way, that's really what makes beautiful engineering. And I think that when the aerospace industry gets it right, I think that's really the pinnacle of engineering.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And today, we're going to talk about aerospace engineering. But before we do, I just wanted to say a big thank you to everybody who sent me warm wishes and healing messages. I'm doing very, very well, and I'll make a full recovery after my little incident a few weeks ago. So thank you very much again. I'm very humbled by all the best wishes that I've received. So let's get on with it. Let's talk aerospace engineering. Royal Academy of Engineering Research Fellow. He's heavily published in the sector and has written book chapters and presented to numerous seminars around the world. He has an Honourable Mention Award, third prize in the Clean Sky Academy PhD Awards, a Collier Research Best Paper Award, and an Ian Marshall's Award for Best Student Paper at the International Conference of Composite Structures, and of course the host of the Aerospace Engineering Podcast. Rainer Groh, welcome to Extended.
Great, I'm glad to be here. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much for your time. The podcast is not too old. It's still pretty new. But first of all, you're probably one of our most qualified guests that we've had on the show. Tell me, what does an engineering research fellow do?
Right. I guess qualified, it probably means I'm qualified in an academic sense. So as you pointed out, yeah, I'm a research fellow. So that means I do research and specifically my research is at the University of Bristol. Of course, Bristol is kind of, you know, a home of the British aviation industry. And so what my day to day looks like in terms of my job is that I basically try to answer questions, burning questions that the industry has, or that basically most of the time actually just questions that I have and that my collaborators have about little kind of academic itches that we want to scratch, and basically just trying to find novel solutions to old problems or novel solutions to new problems. And so, yeah, that's basically what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And tell me, you've got a specialism, haven't you, as well? You specialize in a particular sector of engineering.
Sure, yeah. So I specialize in structural engineering, which isn't necessarily specific to aerospace. So in civil engineers employ structural engineers, mechanical engineers do so as well. And it's basically all about trying to, so building structures. Structures are the things that take loads. So in an aircraft, the wings are obviously attached to the fuselage, and we have to make sure that the wings don't snap off. And so anything that has to take loads is basically what a structural engineer works on. And in traditionally speaking, what structural engineers used to do is just to make sure that your structure doesn't fail. So it doesn't deflect too much, and that it basically can do the job that it's supposed, that the structure or the system is supposed to do. But in recent years, the kind of the topic of structural engineering has expanded a little bit, in that we're now also trying to make structures do more things than just resist loads. And those are called multifunctional structures. So structures are now being used to sense their environment. They're being used to change the shape. For example, in an aircraft, we all know that an aircraft has trailing edge flaps and leading edge slats, basically to increase the lift that the wing is able to provide. But what if you could do that not with a separate mechanism? What if the wing could just deform and basically morph to incorporate the functions of the slat and the flap? So that's really what I do. That is my specialism, is kind of the structures 2.0, going beyond just carrying loads and making sure that the structure doesn't fail.
Yeah. And Rainer, how does that then, I suppose, feed itself into the sector and the sort of work and your colleagues and collaborators do? How does that then manifest itself in designs, in things we could touch, feel, or see? What's the sort of process that goes on?
Sure. So, I mean, specifically, I work in composite materials, so carbon fiber materials, fiberglass materials. And the reason why they're attractive for these multifunctional materials is that they're built from the bottom up. So if you think about any steel structure or an aluminium structure, what tends to happen is that you have a billet of material, and then you, by subtraction, remove everything else that is not your structure. You subtractively manufacture things away. But just like with 3D printing, in composite materials, you're building the material from the ground up, layer by layer. So as the name suggests, a composite material is a union of two different materials. And with carbon fiber and glass fiber, it's typically some form of plastic. And then there are fibers that run within the plastic. And of course, a fiber, just kind of like your hair, doesn't have a lot of structural rigidity and strength. And the plastic on its own isn't very strong either. It's actually quite flexible. But when you combine the two things together, you get something that is better than the two constituent materials on their own. And so you have these individual layers of carbon fiber, fiberglass, and then you build this up layer by layer in a laminate. And what that allows you to do, this additive manufacturing process, is allows you to add other things into the manufacturing process. So, for example, you could add layers of a piezoelectric material, which means that any piezoelectric material, if you apply a charge to it, an electric charge, it basically wants to deform. So now you can start to see the idea that, okay, if I have a composite material and within two layers I add a piezoelectric patch, and I can now apply a voltage to it, and I can control the voltage with a computer and a control system, I can get my structure to deform on demand.
Ah, right. Yeah, I was going to say I understand. Of course I don't. I think I understand the form that you're talking about. And that's really fascinating. Let me come back and ask you a little bit more about that in a moment. But how does one get to the sort of place that you're at? What's your background? What was your education path?
Sure. So I'm originally from Germany, and I grew up in Frankfurt. And when I finished my German high school or sixth form, I decided to come to the UK, and I studied mechanical engineering at the University of Bath. And when I finished my degree, my undergraduate degree, I had a great time in my final year working on my master's project, which was in the aerospace sector, was an aerospace related project. And I really just wanted to kind of explore the idea of research a little bit more. So I decided to do a PhD, and I found a funded position at the University of Bristol, where I still am at now. And so I did a 4-year PhD project in composite materials. And you basically then just take it, you know, step by step. I finished my PhD, and then you do what is, I did something that's called a postdoc, so postdoctoral training, which basically means that after you finish your PhD, you work on another research project. And when I finished that, which was in March this year, I basically applied for my own funding to the Royal Academy, who now funds me. And I'm so now basically doing my own research, which basically means, of course, I interact with my fellow collaborators, but I set my own research agenda.
So where does, I suppose, you mentioned briefly aerospace and aviation. Do you have an interest? Did you ever have an interest in that? Or is it really through your educational path you came into aerospace?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think initially when I was a teenager, I was always interested in aerospace, but I was interested in the kind of extreme end of things. So, you know, going to space, rocket science, deep space exploration, and kind of science fiction, Isaac Asimov and things like this. I wasn't very interested in, I didn't try to become a glider pilot. I wasn't necessarily very interested in commercial flight. But that developed during my degree. So during my degree, I kind of figured out that I was quite good at the structural engineering side of things. And then I just kind of realized that some of the really interesting problems are in aviation. And I then kind of, yeah, started going down the rabbit hole and really haven't looked back since then.
Well, that's quite interesting because I want to come and ask you a little bit about the blog in a moment, because there's some fascinating reading there. And I wouldn't want anyone for one moment to think that your focus is in one particular area. You've got a very broad focus in the aerospace sector. But tell us, from some of the guests, I've picked up that you may have had some role to play directly in the industry. What sort of things have you been doing or are doing at the moment that are directly related to the industry today?
So you mean in terms of my research or in terms of my research? Well, I mean, so I work on light. So part of the research that I do is in this multifunctional structures and trying to add additional functionality into structures. But the other part of my research is on lightweight design. And of course, carbon fiber materials, fiberglass materials are increasingly being used in the aerospace industry. So the first aircraft to ever use more than 50% of carbon fiber material, or in general composite material, was the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, closely followed by the Airbus A350. And in this case, the kind of driving factor behind that is really that you want to make your structure as light as possible. With the strict environmental regulations that we have in terms of reducing emissions, reducing noise, reducing NOx emissions, you want to make your structure as light as possible. Of course, there's also an economic incentive behind this, because if you have a lighter aircraft, it immediately means it, so it's more fuel efficient. You can put more cargo into the aircraft. That's great for airlines. And the ultimate driver behind Airbus and Boeing is always the airline. If no airline wants to buy your aircraft, then Boeing and Airbus are going out of business. So the kind of lightweighting side is a big driver in the industry. And in recent years, it's been heavily driven by composite materials. I mean, composite materials have been around for a very long time. They were used in the military setting in the 60s and the 70s. And in fact, the old the aircraft establishment at Farnborough was actually leading in developing modern composite materials. But they have only really found their way onto commercial aircraft, the big jumbo jets, in recent years. And so what I did as part of my PhD was I looked at carbon fiber materials where the fibers aren't straight. And that sounds very simple, basically – if you look at a piece of carbon fiber material, it's basically, so as the name suggests, they're carbon fibers. They're all straight in straight paths, and they're held together by plastic.
But if we think about how nature uses composite materials, and wood, for example, is a great natural composite that was, for example, used in the aerospace industry on the de Havilland Mosquito during World War II, wood tends to direct its natural fibers in curvy linear directions. So, for example, if you have a tree trunk and a branch branches away from the trunk, then the fibers will naturally follow the path directly from the trunk into the branch. Equally, the tree will direct its fibers around and not a defect in the tree trunk. And so the idea behind these curvilinear carbon fiber materials is to kind of replicate this phenomenon that we see in nature. So the way that you can envision this, for example, is that if you have a carbon fiber fuselage and a carbon fiber wing, you could steer the fibers directly from the fuselage into the wing and thereby reduce a hard joint between the fuselage and the wing, but also make that joint a little bit stronger. That was basically the topic of my PhD, looking at these curvilinear carbon fiber materials. And as you pointed out in the introduction, the European Commission really liked that work, and they gave me a little prize for that as well, which was great.
There's a link to your thesis paper as well on your blog, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'll put links to that in our show notes. Well, we've talked a little bit there and mentioned the industry a little bit. As we record this today, July the 24th, Farnborough is now behind us. Big aerospace exhibition for the UK. But tell me, Rainer, I know you don't work in the industry directly, but tell me some of your opinions about the health of the sector, because I see more and more talk about aerospace engineering capabilities or lack of, but also our particular strengths in this part of the world. What's your view?
I'm certainly the composite material side. That is, I'm very well. Well, I'm intimate with kind of the health of the sector in the UK, and that is definitely a strong point of the UK. But speaking more generally, I think there recently has been a strong focus on establishing or re-establishing space ventures in the UK, and we saw that a couple of years ago with the establishment of the Harwell Space Cluster, just outside of Oxford, which has a couple of really great space startups. One of which I actually interviewed for my podcast called Oxford Space Systems, who are basically building deployable space structures for satellites. But Oxford Space Systems is only one of many new space startups in the UK. And the UK government and the UK Space Agency have been very proactive in funding these new ventures. So I think in that regard, the sector is very healthy. We also see Glasgow basically launching more satellites, or more satellites are being built in Glasgow than anywhere else in Europe, which is, when I heard that fact, I was quite baffled, because Glasgow to me sounds like a shipbuilding industry city. But
But then again, you know, I suppose if we think about it, Bristol has a similar heritage, doesn't it? You know, British Aerospace, or what is now British Aerospace, has a strong presence in that part of the world. Historically, I suppose it would have been shipbuilding and engineering. And listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this. Now, I know that you have a particular interest in the space sector. How exciting is this sector at the moment to you, just out of interest?
I think it's absolutely exciting. It probably also shows in the fact that I'm trying to get a lot of new companies on the podcast to speak to these founders of what they want to do. But, I mean, to be able, if you think about if the current plans work out, which is basically to say that sometime within the 2020s, we will have a spaceport somewhere up in northern Scotland, launching satellites into polar orbits or sun synchronous orbits, that would be absolutely fascinating. I mean, I have been to a SpaceX launch in Florida.
Oh, okay.
And just the kind of, I mean, it's if you haven't been to a rocket launch, the only thing that you can kind of compare it to is I went to Fairford Air Show this year. Yeah. And the F-35 was flying, and the kind of reverberations and, you know, the shock that you get when this aircraft flies past you, it's kind of like that, only that it's 10 kilometers away. So you've got this rocket taking off 10 kilometers away from you, and you can feel the kind of shuddering in your bones. It's really, really awe-inspiring. And so if we could have, you know, something like that in northern Scotland, I think it would be immensely powerful for inspiring the future generation of engineers, but also for the economy as a whole, because it would basically set up an entirely new supply chain for satellite companies, for rocket companies such as Orbex and Skyrora, and I think it would be immensely a positive development for the UK economy.
Yeah, I agree. So what sort of things does the sector really need to do to grow in, I suppose, in aerospace, and particularly from your perspective, from an engineering perspective? Do we need more people? Is it the supply chain? Is it skills? What is it, do you think, that we need to do?
I think on one hand, so going back to kind of the new corporations, startup companies, I think it's a multifaceted question, and there's multiple things that play a role, and I'll try to cover a couple of them. I think on one hand, you definitely need the funding. And in the space sector, the UK government has been very, very good with funding new companies. And the difficulty with funding new companies is really that if you have 10 companies, you have to plan that 9 of them will fail. But if one of them just makes it into a multi-billion pound business, you make, you know, your investments, that investment for the 10 of them was worth it. But the problem is you don't know beforehand which one of the 10 is going to make it. So what I'm a big advocate of is that you fund new ventures with a base amount of kind of seed money, just a couple of million pounds, to basically get them off the ground, and then you will very quickly realize which of the ideas have traction and which don't. And I think that in the space sector, the UK has done a great job at this. Yeah. Where I don't think they've done a very good job is in the commercial sector. And I'm continuously baffled by the amount of great ideas that are coming out of kind of British one-man operations that are trying to, especially in the electric aviation space, trying to build companies, and they can't even get hold of the minimum amount of funding to bring their idea to the marketplace. And again, we're not talking about massive amounts of money. It's just a little bit of seed funding just to get them off the ground. So I think a diversification to kind of to think, okay, which
are the sectors that will be growing in the next couple of years, which will be electric aviation, which will be the space sector, and then not only supporting the big players like they have done in the commercial aviation sector with, for example, Airbus, Siemens, and Rolls-Royce in the EFANX project, but to also give some seed money to smaller companies. I think that is a very, very important factor. The second thing is, of course, as you alluded to, getting the right people or enough people into the industry. And I guess this is where I kind of come in, being in academia. I also teach aerospace engineering. I teach structural engineering here at the University of Bristol. And the most important thing for us is to make sure that the people that have decided to study aerospace engineering stay in the industry and don't go and take a finance job in London or something of the sort. Yeah. That we're passionate about the subject to basically guarantee that they're of course passionate because they chose to decide, they chose to study the subject, that they stay in the industry. And then that of course trickles further down then to the grassroots level, inspiring the next generation, the younger kids, both male and female, getting the maximum amount of people to think about engineering as a career choice.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's a fantastic summary, I think, of where we need to be and where we need to go. While we're on the educational sector, we do have some listeners who are looking to go into aerospace engineering. There's one in particular in my mind. I won't mention him. I won't embarrass him. But I often hear about limited opportunities and he's finding it very difficult to know where to turn to and that sort of thing. What sort of advice can you give some individuals like that who may not be, and take this in the spirit it's intended, right at the top of the academic world, such as yourself, but may potentially be wanting to get into the sector, maybe not through that route?
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right that, I mean, if you want to study engineering, it is definitely the case that A levels in maths and physics are going to increase your chances of getting a spot at university. Yeah. But equally, I think that especially in the UK, apprenticeships are highly underrated. So I come from Germany, where apprenticeships have a much higher value in society, and they are considered a great stepping stone to either a career in industry. Or if you finish an apprenticeship and you decide you want to do further education, then you can do so at a university, or I guess we still have polytechnics in Germany, at a polytechnic university. So I would strongly encourage anybody that is interested in aerospace to consider the possibility of an apprenticeship. And even before that, to try to get an internship somewhere at a company. The internship might not be paid. It might be a summer internship. But I think a lot of young people have very idealistic ideas of what they want to do, the career that they want to pursue. But then when they realize what the day-to-day looks like in these companies, they might not actually like that particular sector. And they might figure out that it's actually something entirely different that they want to do. And in fact, that's actually precisely what happened to me. So I did an internship during my undergraduate degree at Airbus and at Eurocopter, which is now Airbus Helicopters. And I was doing kind of the structural engineering that an entry-level graduate would do. And I found myself not really enjoying that sort of work. And I really wanted to work on the conceptual side of things, you know, coming up with the new designs, testing them. And that was another reason why I pursued research in the end. So I would really encourage anybody, any young person listening, to try to get internships. Engineering companies are actually, if you write to them via email, it's never been easier to contact someone at these big or small companies, to contact them about your passion and that you want to just learn about the sector, what it's like to work for one of these companies. And then if you do like it, either try and go for an apprenticeship or basically, yeah, I guess try to focus as hard as possible on your exams to be able to get a university place.
Wonderful advice. Thank you very much for that. I think that's very, very, very sound.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Moving on then, a great resource that I would say I'd stumbled across, but when your podcast came out, I looked at, was your blog. And before we talk about the podcast, I don't want to let your webpage go untold, because it's absolutely fascinating. I couldn't get off the Get Started page. And the reason I say that is you have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 categories covering the whole aerospace sector of papers, everything from the birth of the jet engine to rocket science. And one of the most fascinating sections was all about jet engines and how particular elements of them work. And I think most of our listeners know I'm certainly not an engineer, but I found it fascinating, easy to read, easy to follow. What a fantastic website you've got.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Rainer, I don't mean to just flatter you. I genuinely believe this is a fantastic web page because of the things you've talked about. It's a resource for people who want to come into the industry and also for those in the industry to see everything from how jet engines work through to composites and aircraft design and human fallibility even. Fantastic webpage. How then did the podcast come about?
The podcast came about in a very similar way to the webpage, actually. So, you know, thanks a lot again for your kind words. It really means a lot to me, because what I really wanted to do was to provide an educational resource. And this, it started when I began my PhD work in 2011, that I thought, well, I'm going to be learning a lot in the next 5 years. Why don't I keep a log of the things that I learn? And so with the webpage, it basically very just quickly turned into me just reading up on things that I was interested in and then almost keeping a diary. Of course, that meant that some things were a bit more mathematical, just because I had, you know, sometimes a bent to read more mathematical things. But as you pointed out, sometimes it's about human fallibility in piloting aircraft, and sometimes it's about the history of rockets or something like that. So I basically just try to kind of scratch my own itch and read up about the industry and then kind of provide a log. But then in terms of the podcast, the way that happened is that I thought, well, I'll try to expand the kind of educational side a little bit, because I just realized that I was going to conferences all over the world for my academic career, as part of my academic career. And I was speaking to lots of fascinating people at NASA, for example. So I did a 3-month placement at NASA Langley Research Center. And of course, they're fascinating people there. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Hidden Figures, but I actually work during my internship in that building where the whole thing is filmed, and you know they're working away crunching the numbers. So there's some absolutely fascinating characters and engineers that work there. And so I just thought, oh, it'd be a shame if these conversations that I'm having with engineers around the world would, you know, not get told to a wider audience. So then I just thought, okay, well, I'll make an effort to record the conversations. Of course, it would have to be a little bit more formal, kind of an interview format. But that's how it all got started. And in fact, the first episode was one of my colleagues that I worked with at NASA Langley. And then the second episode was basically my PhD supervisor, who is an absolutely fascinating guy. And he's got a long career in aerospace research, and he's done some great work. And I just thought, you know, some in the wider world has to know about what what Professor Paul Weaver worked on. So I just tried to put aerospace engineers in the spotlight. And then that kind of evolved into just trying to look at the things in the industry that are novel, not just in academia, but also little startup companies. And I kind of tried to focus on the UK where I work. So I looked, I've spoken to people in Gloucestershire that are trying to build new hybrid electric aircraft. The most recent one was on contra-rotating propellers, which are very, very difficult and complex to make work when you have a gas-powered engine because of the complexity involved and the gearboxes and everything else. But once you have an electric motor, it's actually a lot simpler. And so I've just basically thought, okay, I need to speak to all these people that are coming up with crazy new ideas or just refining old ones, and basically tell their stories. So that's, how the podcast came about.
Well, it is fascinating, and I love podcasts anyway, particularly about this sector. These aren't difficult to follow. They're not highly technical, but they're technical enough to make the subjects viable in their own right. But I think the great thing, and I think we're up to episode 15 today, is the variety. You cover everything from Concorde to Purland to, as you say, electric propulsion, rocket engines. So in the first 15 episodes, if some of the people listening haven't, there's some fantastic ones to pick out there as well. Have you got a favorite?
That's a great question. Do I have a favorite? I think one of my favorites was definitely the one on the Purland project, because, I mean, these guys are basically aerospace enthusiasts and engineers all around the world. They all live in different places around the globe, and they're building a glider that flies to 90,000 feet. Mm. And the amount of engineering that goes into that, and it's, you know, this isn't an industrial corporation. Of course, they're currently sponsored by Airbus, and I'm sure Airbus provides them with some level of support, but it's still very, very tricky to build anything that flies to 90,000 feet. And now it's an unpowered aircraft. I think that the whole premise just blew my mind. And when I spoke to the chief engineer, Morgan Sandercock, it was just very obvious how passionate he was about the whole endeavor. And I thought that was an absolutely fascinating episode.
And do you think, Rainer, that you used the word passion there, and I've used it a lot in my past as well. Do you think that's something about this sector that makes it almost unique? Because there's, you know, there's shipbuilding, there's railways, there's other technologies creeping in. Most people see it as a challenge or a goal in its own right, but very few of them sort of seem to have the passion that this sector drives. It's an unusual thing. And, you know, you're in academia in this sector, but you use the same words that I use. Just is that something that sort of comes from the being a bit soft, the heart that seems to spread across this sector?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I think, again, when I was at Fairford Airshow this year, it's incredible how many people come to see you know, the Red Arrows fly, for example, or military aircraft fly. So there is definitely a big element of passion that goes with the aerospace industry. And I think it's to some degree this kind of feeling that it's kind of too good to be true. You've got this kind of heavy machinery, which really shouldn't be flying, but it is. So
that's amazing, because it's amazing that a research fellow from the Royal Academy of Engineering uses those words, because I don't class myself in any way as being technical. But that's my fascination with the sector. It doesn't feel right, but it does. And we all understand we generally understand how it works. But it's amazing that someone of your education and stature in the sector uses those same terms.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes, of course, if you look into the maths behind it, I think this is sometimes the argument that is made that, mathematicians and physicists, they take all the beauty away from nature by just deconstructing it into its fundamental mechanisms. But in fact, that is not true. You're just adding an additional layer of beauty, really. You understand, you have an appreciation for the aesthetic, and then you have an appreciation for the mechanism behind it. And it's the same with aviation. You've got the appreciation for a beautifully designed aircraft and the fact that it can soar up into the sky and the pure power of a jet engine. But equally, you appreciate the maths that makes it all work and the physics that makes it all work. And I think that combination, when you have art and science interact in that way, that's really what makes beautiful engineering. And I think that when the aerospace industry gets it right, I think that's really the pinnacle of engineering.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm fascinated by it all. Tell me a little bit about your visit to Fairford. Were you working, spectating, or just enjoying the show?
Yeah, I was just spectating and enjoying the show. I mean, I had never been to Fairford before.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's father actually convinced me. He was like, you have to go. I mean, you can't not go to Fairford. I mean, it's a great air show. So I thought, okay, let's go to Fairford. And I'd been to Berlin air show earlier this year in April, but Fairford is a completely different air show. It's not necessarily, it's not about commercial aviation and selling aircraft. It's really about the joy of flying and the raw power of flying. And the Red Arrows were there, and the Italian flying squadron were there. And it was just an absolute incredible display of aviation. It was really great. I really enjoyed myself.
Wonderful. Well, let's go back to the podcast. Where can we find out a little bit more about the podcast? Where can we find you online?
So the URL to the podcast is aerospaceengineeringblog.com/podcast. But you can, of course, also just, if you Google or any other search engine, you put in aerospace engineering podcast, it should really come straight up. I'm also on Twitter and on LinkedIn, so people can also find me there. That's basically the best places to find out more about the podcast.
Well, Rainer, it's been absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate your time and your insight into the sector. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Peter. I really had a blast. It was absolutely great talking to you.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation, and most of all, the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
What a wonderful man Rainer is. I really enjoyed that interview. Just a few shout-outs just before we go. I'd like to say a big hello to Emma Braden from Ireland. Just wanted to say a big thank you for supporting Extended. I also want to say what a hero your dad is. Lovely guy. Also, big shout-out to FAST. That is, of course, the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. Fantastic work they do. They, of course, they were founded to safeguard Farnborough's priceless aeronautical heritage, and that's very relevant after today's programme. So they work to preserve and promote the heritage in aviation science, and they do fantastic work. Registered charity, they do have some events coming up. It is a museum in its own right. If you haven't visited it, it's fabulous. They've got some real great aerospace historical artifacts in there. They also have events, and I do believe they have an event coming up. So a little mention to that. It's on the 11th of September at 7:30 in Farnborough at the Village Hotel. And it's by Paul Brooks, and it's high altitude, long endurance flight where Farnborough still leads the world. So go over to their website, that's airsciences.org.uk, to find out a little bit more. And if you get the opportunity, Farnborough's taken all the headlines in the last few weeks, but don't miss out on the Air Sciences Trust. Fabulous work they do, and a fabulous museum as well. And finally, just a little mention to our very good friends at Event Fire Solutions, and of course the aviation historian who support the show, who help to promote the show, so we're very, very grateful for everything that they do to help us stay on the airwaves. That's about it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show, and of course if you really want to support us, do go over and leave some feedback on Apple iTunes or Apple Podcast Player, or whatever podcast playing app you have. Like our Facebook page, give us a score, give us some feedback, and of course over on Twitter you'll find us as well. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Tim on Twitter at R-A-E-S, Tim R, if you're not one of the many thousands that he doesn't already have. But you can also find Gareth on Gareth_Stringer on Twitter. And of course, you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, lurking around on our Facebook page, and of course, the Aviation and Aerospace Podcast Group on Facebook. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
This is XTP Media.